pick up where we left off. We're going to have to move a little faster, so I'm going to start omitting some details. Last time then we were trying to compute the degree of the map, which is multiplication by n. So we have an abelian variety, A. And defined over some field F. And actually this is going to be true over any field, but of course we're interested in the case of finite fields. So let's assume the characteristic of F is P, which is positive. And we have the multiplication by N map. So N is an integer. And we have the map, which I might denote maybe square bracket N, just to make it clear, it sends a point P to N times P. In other words, P added to itself N times. And we're trying to figure out the size of the kernel of this map. And I think I already showed you that this is an isogeny, that is, at least that the kernel is finite. And so we know kernel of bracket N is finite, and we want to figure out what is its size. So one way of doing that first is to compute the degree of this map, and if we have that, then we know that generically that then the kernel, that is the number of points on P such that NP is zero, will be equal to the separable degree, which I think I denoted by S. So in general, this map N, in general, N is not separable. And last time we discussed a little bit about separability and inseparability in terms of field extensions. So, now the question is then, what can we say about this degree and therefore about the number of pre-images of zero? So firstly, in the case that N is not divisible by the characteristic, it's easier to compute the degree. You can do this by intersection theory. Actually, you can always compute the full degree, and the question is, though, but since this is the quantity you're interested in, then you want to be able to compute the separable degree. So the full degree can be computed using intersection theory. And there are other proofs, but this seems to be the cleanest. So you take divisors, D1 of D divisors, so D is the dimension of A, so these are divisors, and let's assume there's something about them, like they're in general position, so that we have a well-defined concept of the intersection D1 dot DD, the intersection product makes sense. And gives an integer. So I have codimension D codimension one things, and I'm intersecting them. Each time I intersect with an additional one, I'm cutting down the dimension, so increasing the codimension. So this is finally if I intersect D of them, I get a codimension zero thing, which is a set of points. And so I can add up those points, assigning multiplicities to each of those points, and I get a number. That's the intersection product. If they are in good position, that's what I meant of taking them in general position, then this is essentially the same in general. This is the same as the cardinality of the finite set but in the intersection product is supposed to be a subtler thing, which is supposed to take into account the way things intersect, in other words, associating multiplicities. Now, intersection products have the following functorial property with respect to a map such as N from A to A. So, given a map, given a map F from A to A, we can ask the following. So, we have divisors on this copy of A, we can pull them back by F and intersect them, or we can intersect them on the original copy of A itself. And in that case, we get two numbers here. How are they related? The relationship is by the degree. Okay, then. So if we were to write F star D1 intersected with F star D sub D, this thing is can be compared to the intersection product D1 to DD, and the scalar that comes out in front is the degree of F. I wonder, did they fix this point? Yeah. So in the case of our map multiplication by N, so in our case, we are interested in F is multiplication by N, and we choose exactly the opposite of what I said we should choose, namely divisors in general position. We choose them all the same. And this D, I want to choose it, I want to choose where D is ample and symmetric. Remember, we spoke about ample divisors. It means the corresponding line bundle has enough sections. And symmetric means here, symmetric means that minus 1 when applied to D is D. So the map from A to A that sends P to minus P induces a map on divisors, and if I pull back a divisor according to that map minus 1, then I still get D. That's what it means to be symmetric. And you see, the point is such divisors exist because you can start with ample divisors, which already, you know, exist. So, and then you can symmetrize them by replacing D with D plus minus 1 star D. That's still ample. And now you've symmetrized it. So you can always choose such divisors. Such divisors exist. Now, if you consider N star acting on such a divisor, well, we had a general theorem about how I believe we proved a general theorem, I hope we did, about what happens when you, I think it was the last time, that when I apply the map, when I pull back a line bundle by the map multiplication by N, you remember the theorem that said I can identify that with a tensor power of L and a tensor power of L inverse. And we identified which powers those were. But if you use that theorem, then what you will get here, and now I'm writing it in terms of divisors. Last time we wrote it in terms of line bundles, so there were tensor powers of line bundles. you know that L1 tensor L2 corresponds to D1 plus D2, right? The line bundles add, line bundles multiply, divisors add. So there I expressed N star L as L to the tensor power, I think it was N squared plus N over 2, tensor minus 1 star L inverse to the power N squared minus N over 2. So here it's going to be in terms of multiplication instead of tensor power. So this thing is N squared plus N over 2 applied to D plus minus 1 star N squared minus N over 2 applied to D. But as I chose D to be symmetric, minus 1 star D is the same, so therefore this whole thing just comes out to be N squared D. So if I choose a such a divisor, then I have multiplication by N behaving like just multiplying the divisor by N squared. And so if you put that fact into this relation here, then you see that N to the 2D times the default intersection of D with itself, maybe just write that as D to the D, where D to the D now means default intersection of D with itself, this thing is equal to the degree of multiplication by N times D to the D. Now it's a fact that we can, this D to the D, this intersection is not zero. And so what this tells us, so this I'm just stating as a fact, and therefore you get that the degree of this multiplication by N is N to the 2D. Okay, so therefore this computes the degree for any N. It doesn't make any assumption about the characteristic or whether N is prime to the characteristic. But the problem is now that since we're interested in the set of points killed by N or that group scheme, we need to know more than just the degree. We need to know the separable degree. So the first thing you see from this is that if P doesn't divide N, that P is the characteristic of the field, then this thing is a separable map. It's a separable isogeny. Because inseparability only comes from powers of P that divide the degree. So there is no power of P here. So therefore, what that tells you is, therefore, this A bracket N has order N to the 2D, cardinality N to the 2D, for P not dividing N. But more than that is also evident. In fact, we know we can clarify the group structure, A bracket N as a group. See, by the way, when P doesn't divide N, the subtle problems of non-reduced don't enter. You've got the full set of points. Pardon? Multiplication by N, yeah. So A bracket N. Kernel. Inseparability, yeah, well, the point is it's like this. A polynomial of degree D should have D roots in the algebraic closure. And when does that fail to happen? It's all issues of inseparability, right? And inseparability means roots are collapsing. Well, the group scheme still sees all those elements, and so the only way this collapses is by introducing nilpotents into the structure sheaf. Okay, so we can say something more here. Moreover, for any divisor M of N the set of elements of order M, of order dividing M, in A bracket N is A bracket M. This family of groups, you see, fits together nicely as I vary N. If I have a divisor of N and I'm looking for the elements in here which have order dividing M, it's exactly this, what happened at the Mth layer, by definition of this thing, right? It means it's, these are points killed by N, these are points killed by M. So if it has order dividing M, then it's killed by M and therefore must lie in here. And now here's is a general exercise, if you like, if you want to take it as an exercise or a fact, that if you have an abelian group, finite abelian group, and it has, let's say, a G of order N to the D, and but not call it D because we have actually N to the 2D, so N to the K, with this property, with the property that for all divisors, M dividing N, the subgroup of elements of order dividing M has order M to the K, then G is isomorphic to its cyclic, it's a product of cyclic groups of order Z mod N. Okay, you can prove that by induction if you like. If you have an abelian group, certainly it's a product of cyclic groups, and you know it's killed by N to the K, but it, right here it could be maybe Z mod N to the KZ. Or it could be Z mod N plus Z mod N to the K minus 1 Z. You know, there are many different ways of writing down an abelian group of this order. But if you impose this extra condition that for any divisor, the number of elements of order dividing that divisor has this order, then it's got to look like this. There's no choice. Okay? So therefore, this in particular, what that tells us is that if P doesn't divide N, then A bracket N as a group now is isomorphic to Z mod N to the 2D. Now, there's a finer structure, of course, that one might want to consider, not just as abelian groups, but as group schemes. And even if you didn't want to go into the language of schemes, you see there's a finer structure that you would want to study here in terms of Galois action. See, A is defined over some field, and multiplication by N is some morphism. It has a kernel. It's an algebraic map, so the kernel consists of points which have algebraic coordinates. And so Galois, F bar over F, acts on those points. And so you can ask, what is this as a Galois module? See, this doesn't tell you anything about that. This is just elucidating the abelian group structure. A more subtle problem would be to ask, what about the Galois module structure? And then in the case of other cases, so even in this case, you might ask, what is the group scheme structure? Now, if P does divide N, then the problem is a little subtler. If P divides N, then in fact this is not separable. And one can show the following, that the degree, the separable degree, is at most, actually is a, firstly it's a power of P, maybe we call it the R, where R is some number between R, between 0 and D. So the fact that firstly R can only go up to D tells you that there is an inseparable part, right? Because the degree of N is P to the 2D. We already computed it. But actually here I have to be a little bit careful, and what am I talking about here? This is multiplication by P. In general, if N is composed of a part which is divisible by P and a part which is prime to P, you have to separate out those two parts. And using basically Chinese remainder theorem, you can express A bracket N as a product of something that looks like that, plus some other weird group scheme. Okay, this R is called the P rank of A. And I repeat, this is what we, the kind of phenomena I showed you already for roots of unity, pth roots of unity in characteristic P, there aren't any, except one. Right? You cannot have any non-identity pth roots of unity. Similarly, there's a collapse going on, a morphism that has degree P to the 2D picks up only at most P to the D points in the kernel. Okay, so I think what I'm going to do is illustrate this in the dimension one case. Yeah, you had a question.
No, they're only
P to the R points.
Okay, so points there, and each one of them has multiplicity.
Kind of, you can say multiplicity if you think of it in the, yeah. They're thickened points.
Right.
But actually, in terms of group schemes, because the group scheme looks at the, you know, ring of functions, you actually can separate out the group scheme into what's called, into the reduced part and the local part. And the local part has all the things which are not points. I don't think we will, initially I was going to cover group schemes, but then I realized that maybe, you know, in terms of what I should restrict myself to only the things we're actually going to use. And I don't at the moment see a theorem we're going to need group schemes, so I won't cover it. But that you can classify what this group scheme looks like. And as I said, part of it is a reduced part, which will be coming from the separable part, and then there's a local part. And then the local part you can push it forward and classify it. There's lots of work done on that. And you get some group, weird group schemes. Some that you recognize, like Z mod P or mu P, you know, P thirds of unity, but then some weird ones like alpha P, you know, so very weird group schemes and weirder ones than that. Okay, so let me now talk a little bit about dimension one case. And even here we'll have to, I think there'll be some things that come in that you'll have to accept on faith. But I want to show you this dimension one case because it illustrates some ideas that later Tate developed in more generality. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let me see now. D to the D will live in H0, right? And H0 is one dimensional. Yeah, sorry, H2D. H2D, yeah. Yeah, which is one dimensional. It has a. You get zero?
Yeah.
It doesn't. Yeah, it's an exterior algebra over H1. So, it's an exterior algebra over H1, and D lives in H2. Right? So, so D to the D actually will be, you can find a D that is a non-zero multiple of the volume form. Okay, so let's see, what does this say? Example discussion. What does this say in the case of dimension 1? So D equals 1 is some, I'm assuming, a case that's familiar to you. So we're talking about, so in this case A, I will write E for elliptic curve. And it's familiar to you because either you already know it or you've heard enough about this in other courses in this workshop, in this theme program. So in this case, so we have an elliptic curve over a field F characteristic P, which is positive. Although what I'm going to say is true even in characteristic zero. So in this case, E bracket 2, let me assume that P is bigger than 2. It's not an essential restriction. P equals 2 is created to annoy people, I think. So E bracket 2 in this case has 4 points. I don't lose any because of inseparability delta. So E bracket 2 consists of 4 points. The point identity plus, let's say, 3 points, P1, P2, and P3. Because according to that, I know it's got 4 points, right? 2 squared. Now, from Riemann-Roch, which I can use classical Riemann-Roch because these are curves, although you may not think of it classical because I'm over a field of positive characteristic, but let's say we do know that. So by Riemann-Roch, there is a function. So there is a function, the space of functions F on E with the property that the divisor of F plus 2 times the origin is bigger than or equal to 0. In other words, the set of rational functions on E with the property that it has at most a pole of order 2 at 0 and no other poles. This thing is a two-dimensional space. It's two-dimensional, of dimension 2. If you like, what Riemann-Roch tells you is the dimension of this space, which I might write L2O, minus the dimension of the space K minus 2O, where K is the canonical class, is 2. And the canonical class here has a degree 0 because I'm in the case of an elliptic curve. So this thing here has negative degree. Degree is minus 2. So there are no functions there. So that's 0. Therefore, this is 0. And so L of 2O is 2. And so I can pick, by Riemann-Roch, the space is of dimension 2. That's what I mean here. Therefore, we can choose a non-constant, we can choose a non-constant function function in this space, okay, denote it by x. Okay, so I've chosen a function on the elliptic curve which has the property that the only pole that it has is a pole of order at most 2 at O. And in fact, I can choose it to have pole x, then x has a pole of order, has a pole at O of order equal to 2. Okay, and that's not a simple pole. Why? Because I could have done this calculation with L of O. And then I would get L of O is 1. Right? Okay. Okay. And by replacing x with x minus a constant, say, we may suppose that x vanishes at P1. This 0 is actual number 0, as opposed to O, which is the 0 element in the group. Okay? We may suppose that x vanishes at P1. And in fact, let me see. In fact, I want to claim it's a double zero. I just state it. You can verify. In fact, it is a double zero. So this needs to check. So x has a double zero at P1. Now, since it's got a double pole at O, it's not allowed to have any other zeros because the degree has to be zero. Degree of a function is zero. So it's got no other zeros and no other poles. In fact, it is a double zero and X has no other poles or zeros. Yeah, it's just let me see. The only thing we know about P1 is that it's a point of order 2. And let me think now. So you have a pole of order 2 at O. I guess the question is why can't it have a simple zero at P1 and a simple zero at some other point. And you can choose X to have a pole of order 2 at zero, and then by translating it you can assume it vanishes at P1, but I want to make it a double zero. So your question is, am I using there the fact that P1 is a point of order 2? Yeah. So, but let's see, what's the argument? So I have a 2 to 1 map. You're saying I have a 2 to 1 map like that, and I have something which vanishes zero. Yeah, this needs a little bit of argument. That's why I just said in fact. Just think about it for a moment. I don't see the argument right now, but think about it. It's got to have a double zero. In other words, I don't want it to spread out. It's got to have, its totality of zeros has to be degree 2, because it's got a pole of order 2 at O. But I want the two zeros to coincide at P1. Okay. Okay. Pardon?
So you have two ramifications points.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'll leave that to you to check the details. Okay, so we have a double zero. Now, what next? What do we want to do? Okay. Now, by scaling, if necessary. We may suppose that x of p2 is 1. Scaling, of course, won't change the poles and zeros, where it has a pole or where it vanishes. But then I want to normalize so that so here it's got a pole, here it vanishes. Here I want to normalize the value to be 1. And let us denote. You see, you know, it cannot be zero because we've accounted for all the zeros already. So let us denote x of p3 by lambda. So I'm just trying to write for you the lambda equation of the curve. What is it? I think Legendre form, I think it's called. So this lambda is in the field F, but it's not 0 or 1. Okay, now let's look at L of 3O. So this is the set of functions such which have at most a pole of order 3 at O. Then this thing here has dimension 3. And so we can choose a function Y, say, with a pole of order 3 at O, and no other poles. Because you see, the point is L of 2O is only two-dimensional, so there's something in L of 3O that is not in L of 2O. So I can choose a function, let's call it Y, and then it's got to have a pole of order 3 at O. And it doesn't have poles anywhere else because f plus 3o is bigger than or equal to 0. Okay? Now, we can also arrange, y to vanish. We can arrange that y vanishes at p1 and p2. You can do that by subtracting a linear function in x. See, x vanishes at p1 and it takes the value 1 at p2. So by arranging some linear function in x, you can make y vanish at both of these points. Okay? Now, if y vanishes at p1 and p2, then, in fact, must have. Y of P3 equals 0 as well. And again, this is something that you need to check. If Y vanishes at P1 and P2, got a pole of order 3 at O, it's got to vanish at P3 as well. Certainly it's got to vanish at a third point. Yeah. At O. I want. I think it's enough to say I can choose the y. So maybe that's not the right wording, but let me just think. What's the argument? Y vanishes at P1, P2. So certainly it's got a third. Well. Yeah, I know. So that's the other thing we've got to figure out. That okay, so you can make it a simple zero. You see, because how do you do this arrangement here? You subtract, y takes some value at P1, okay, and some value at P2. Now, okay, then I want to take let me see now. Yeah, if I take, let's say y of p1 equals alpha, y of p2 is beta. So what do I want to look at y minus some multiple of x plus some constant. So that this vanishes at, so at p1 this takes the value alpha minus b, and at p2 this takes the value beta minus a plus b. So I need to just choose for a, so b is alpha and then a is alpha minus beta. Okay, so I can choose a and b so that this function vanishes at p1 and p2, and now I want to make them simple zeros as well. Let's see, how will I make them simple zeros? How will we make y have a simple zero there? So really what I'm saying is we can arrange that this happens and zeros are simple. Let's see, if it has a double zero, at P1, this won't see it. Actually, let me say like this. I don't even need, do I need this? Sorry? Why by a function that vanishes at those points? I want to do that without introducing any poles though. Pardon? Okay, so let's think first, do we even need this? Yeah, I want to match. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, I do need that. Y vanishes at P3. Okay, I want it to vanish at P3. Yes. Right. Pardon?
Yeah, actually I do want to relate y and x, but once I have the divisors, you're telling me I can do it the other way around, that I look at x and then I construct y from that. I wanted to claim that, and I think it's true if we get the order of this thing right, that you choose any y which is in this space and not in a smaller space, you can make some lower order modifications to it and you'll get a function satisfying this condition. That is, with a triple pole at zero and actually, I guess, let me see, what happens if you take 3O I would, if I were to sit down and try to prove this rigorously, I would play with Riemann-Roch theorem. So that's what I invite you to do. Okay, so I claim that, and I'll do it, you do the exercise too, use Riemann-Roch. Okay, so I still want to assert that I can find such a Y. But you see, if you have such a y, then the kind of relationship between y and x that you were alluding to will come about, because then y squared and x minus 1, x minus lambda have the same divisors, because they both have a pole of order 6 at O, and they both have zeros of order 2, let's just make sure of that. Certainly left hand side is zero of order 2 at P1, P2 and P3, and the right hand side has, certainly at P1 it vanishes, yes, and because x has a double zero at P1, that's fine. So since x has a double zero at P1, in fact this thing here, when x of P2 equals 1, it means that x minus 1 will have a double zero at P2. So let me leave this as a claim then. Y squared and claim. Y squared and this thing have same divisor, and so differ by a constant, a scalar, a factor. So if you eliminate that factor, you scaling by that factor, you get an equation, y squared equals x minus 1, x minus lambda. This is the classical Legendre form of the equation for an elliptic curve. And this lambda, you see, if you did this in characteristic 0, this lambda is a function, it's a function for the modular group gamma of 2. It gives you a modular function. So if you were to do this, for example, over the complex numbers, then for each elliptic curve, you have a complex parameter z, right, corresponding to the lattice, also aside, over C, an elliptic curve can be represented by a theorem on Riemann surfaces. It's a Riemann surface of genus 1. So any Riemann surface of genus 1 has universal cover of the complex plane, so can be represented as C modulo lattice, and this lattice can be written as Z plus z tau, where tau is a complex number of positive imaginary part. Now, this representation here, lambda, is a map on such things. So let's write H for the upper half plane, the tau in C with positive imaginary part, is a function. You see, on the upper half plane, this is invariant under gamma, under the principal congruent subgroup, gamma of 2. And it's that lambda that is occurring here. So that's another way of parametrizing elliptic curves. The J invariant is yet another way. But this lambda function occurs, so it occurs analytically, but this is, by Riemann-Roch, we should be able to construct it algebraically. That's what we're doing. Okay? So I'm leaving for you some things to fix up here with Riemann-Roch. But my feeling is it's all an exercise with Riemann-Roch. There's nothing more involved. Okay, so you have that. Now, we get to a little bit, we want to talk about the P rank. P rank, yeah, so to compute the P rank, one of the techniques is to look at its action on the tangent space and on the cotangent space. And in the case of an elliptic, in the general case of an abelian variety, you'll get some determinant, some matrix that you have to look at. But in the case of an elliptic curve, it's a one-dimensional space, and so there's an explicit way of writing the P rank. So in the first place, if I look at H0 omega 1, that is holomorphic one forms on E, then this is a one-dimensional space. If you like, it's the cotangent space, and it's generated by, the space is generated by the form dx over y. So dx over y represents a one form on E. In fact, it's an invariant one form, it's translation invariant, and it is everywhere analytic. In other words, it doesn't have any poles. And the point is, if you think of it heuristically like this, x has a pole of order 2 at O, so dx should have a pole of order 3, and y has a pole of order 3, so the poles cancel out. And then in terms of zeros, y has simple zeros at p1, p2, and p3, and x, well, at least at p1, y has a simple zero, and x has a double zero at p1, so dx should have a simple zero at p1. So the order of vanishing and the order of poles match, so dx over y, and you can show that rigorously, the dx over y is a holomorphic one form on E, and by holomorphic I mean that it doesn't have any poles, and it's defined everywhere. Yeah, in fact, it is. Absolutely, yes. No, it's not obvious, but... the point is, it's a... these are the points that are killed by 2, so... No, it's not obvious. I think there's also some choice involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then why does P3 all of a sudden land in?
Yeah. Okay, so you've got to use the fact that these are not just four randomly selected points. They form the subgroup of point of order 2. So there's I guess the point is P3 is P1 plus P2. So there are ways of moving these points around other than by fractional linear transformations. Okay, so anyway, I have dx over y, and it's a fact, and it's again, I'm just going to state this as a fact, that the p, to compute the p rank in the case of an elliptic curve, the p rank is zero. You see, p rank is either zero or one. In the case of a one-dimensional thing, d is one. So the p rank is either zero or one. Which means that the, you see, E bracket P is either 0 or Z mod P. Point of order P in characteristic P, you, according to that, you have only two choices. Either there aren't any, or there are only P, point of order P. And this is not just because of field or definition. This is going to the algebraic closure. I'm not saying that there are no points of order P because my field is too small. Even if you go to the algebraic closure, there are no points. So this is P rank 0, and this is P rank 1. So Hensel's lemma essentially implies, by the way, when you have this, that E of P to the any alpha is either 0 or Z mod P to the alpha. So now, how do we figure out which one is going to happen when? And as I said, there's some theory that tells you, that relates the P rank to what's going, that's what's happening on the Lie algebra, the tangent space. And then from there to H1 of O. And that translation is via Frobenius. So the P rank is 0 of E is 0 if Frobenius acts as 0 on H1O. So O is, of course, not the point, so let's call it OE. O is not the point at infinity. O is the structure sheaf here. So I have a map. You see, what are we trying to look at? We're trying to look at kernel of multiplication by P on the curve. Well, it stands to reason that I should be able to look at what this thing does on the tangent space at the identity. And then multiplication by P on the curve, which is defined by some complicated functions, on the tangent space, E is the linear map multiplication by P. Okay, but now you can translate that from the tangent space to this slightly more complicated space. Instead of multiplication by P, you look at the corresponding action on the sheaf, which is Frobenius. So Frobenius is the map which on the sheaf sends a function to its pth power. And because it's acting on the sheaf, it induces an action on H1. But this is a one-dimensional space, so that action is a scalar. And the P rank is picked up whether that action is zero or not. So if you can identify the action of Frobenius on this one-dimensional space, for the elliptic curve case, you get whether the P rank is zero or not. Now, this space also is not mysterious. Just like here, we could identify a form that generates it. H1OE is also one-dimensional. This is also one-dimensional space. And it's generated by the function y over x.
Okay, H1, think of it as in Czech, given by Czech cohomology. Okay, so I have the curve or Riemann over complex numbers, it's the Riemann surface, and I can think of a function, one cocycle, as being given by one Czech cocycle, and I claim that. So because it's one dimensional, all I have to do is produce a function, a Czech cocycle rather, which is it's not a boundary. Okay? And I'm claiming that in general, this function has the property that it's defined. It makes sense. I need to remove first let's say I have E, and I remove the point at infinity, and I remove P1. So I look at the following, let's say U1 is this, and U, let's say U is this, and V is E minus P1. So that gives me a covering of E, and then I have to define a function on U intersected V. That gives me an element, a chain, a cochain in H1, right, or Z1 or whatever. And then I just have to show it's non-zero. So I'm defining a function here. Non-bounding function. Yeah. I want to show that it's. I want to define a function here, which is not a co-boundary. In other words, can't be written as a difference of two functions: one function defined on U and one function defined on V. I'm constructing a Czech cocycle. So Y over X in that sense, viewed as a function on E minus zero and P1, where it's well defined. Well, X doesn't vanish at P2 or P3. Y does, so it's still a well-defined function. It looks a bit asymmetric, I know.
But no, it's just that I thought you would write down the transition function for the line number, and it shouldn't vanish.
X does not vanish at P2 or P3, just at P1. Okay, so I have Y over X, and now the question is, how can I figure out whether if you give me a function on U intersected V, how can you figure out whether it's a boundary or not? In other words, so let me say like this. Given a function, let's say G, let's call it F. Then given a function, does it represent a non-zero element? H1O. I need to know some way of figuring that out, because now I'm going to apply Frobenius to Y over X. I'm going to get a new function. I've got to figure out, is this zero or not? Because that's how I will figure out the P rank. Well, the point is, there's a simple calculation that you can do here, given a function. If F were zero, that means to be zero in H1 means it's a coboundary. Okay, so that means that it's a Czech coboundary. Then there are functions. This is by definition, G and H, such that F equals G minus H. So here G is defined on U, and H is defined on V. That's how you do Czech boundary maps, right, or co-boundary maps. Okay, but in this case, if I compute the residue of F times this holomorphic differential,
So let's consider residue at P1 of a function f omega. And omega is this form here. So omega is the generator of this space. Okay, it makes sense to speak of the residue with meromorphic functions. Meromorphic, of course, within the algebraic category, you all understand that. I'm using words like holomorphic, meromorphic. You understand we're talking in the algebraic category. Okay, so if a function has property, so let's call this a function f, g, h, I, j, call it, give me a name of a function.
H.
Big H, maybe? I don't want to use these. Okay. Has a property so function H has the property that it has a pole at only one point, then you know the residue theorem tells you that the sum of the residues is zero. Right? So if it has a pole at only one point, then the residue has to be zero. One point, so then let's say P, then the residue has to be zero. If you have a meromorphic function with the property that has a pole only at one point, then the residue has to be zero. Actually, I guess what I want to do is I want to map. I want to even multiply by omega. Omega is a holomorphic differential. And if I had, so now if I apply this thing with the F, suppose F were coboundary, then you see each of these G is defined on E minus O, so it has at most a pole at O. Similarly, H has at most a pole at T1. It doesn't have any other poles. So when I compute this residue in either case, I will get zero. And so when I subtract, if F looks like this, and I compute the residue at P1 of F omega, well, it's the residue at P1 of G omega minus the residue at P1 of H omega. But each of those residues has to be zero, because G and H only have poles at one point, at most. So that would mean that the residue at P1 of F omega would be zero. So if F is a boundary, therefore, if F is a coboundary, then this residue is zero. So now we're going to apply this to compute. You take this form y over x, apply Frobenius to it. Well, according to the definition of Frobenius, you'll get y to the p over x to the p. And then we'll hit it with this holomorphic one form and try to compute the residue at p1. And if you get something non-zero, that means what? That means that Frobenius is acting non-trivially there, and so therefore the p rank is 1. On the other hand, if you get something zero, then the p rank should be zero. Okay. Okay, so we're going to compute, therefore, we want to compute residue at p1 of Frobenius act on this thing here, y to the p over x to the p, times dx over y. Okay, because Frobenius has now been applied to y over x, and I want to make sure I get something non-zero. Or actually, I want to find out, do I get something zero or non-zero, and this tells me that the way I can check that is by computing the residue at P1 of f times dx over y. Okay, so now we're reduced to a calculus question here. So y to the p over x to the p dx over y, this is y to the p minus 1, I do the x, divided by x to the p minus 1 times dx over x. No argument there. By the way, what is dx over x, the residue of this? Well, let's do this. Yeah, maybe I just make the remark. The residue at P1 of dx over x is 2. Because x has a double zero at P1. Right, so x looks like sort of near P1, it looks like x minus P1 squared and something. So dx will have the 2 coming out. Okay, so the residue will be 2. Okay, so now y to the p minus 1 is y squared to the p minus 1 over 2, and y squared is x minus 1, x minus lambda. So this is x to the p minus 1 over 2 times x minus 1 to the p minus 1 over 2 times x minus lambda to the p minus 1 over 2. And so if I divide this by this thing times dx over x, then the residue is going to is this correct? Yeah, it's going to be 2 times the coefficient of x to the p minus 1 over 2 in this thing. You see, I'm taking this thing and dividing by x to the p minus 1. So this goes, and I have this divided by x to the p minus 1 over 2, and then I'm multiplying by dx over x. So to get the residue, it's I'm looking for the what sits in front of 1 over x. And that's going to be, so I just need to compute the coefficient of x to the p minus 1 over 2 here. Yeah. So when I, you're totally lost or just partially? No. Partially lost. Okay. So here, I have this thing, this you agree with, and I divide by x to the p minus 1, then this disappears, and I'm dividing here by x to the p minus 1 over 2. Okay, then I have dx over x. Now, if I want to compute the residue, I'm looking for the coefficient of 1 over x. So I've already computed from this part that coefficient is 2. So I just need to get the constant term of this one. Well, at P1, because I know everything about dx and x. X looks like this, dx looks like 2 times x minus p minus 1 times a unit. So I just need to compute what this is doing near, I just need the constant term of this. That's all. So let's see. So this is giving me, this thing here looks like 2 over x minus p minus 1 plus something, right? And this is giving me, if I get the constant term here, that's okay. Plus, how else can I get, no, the only way, the residue is going to come only from the constant term here.
There's no polar part here? Because I'll just write it down. This is a function. I just wrote it down. Y to the p minus 1 looks like this. Oh, so you're saying x vanishes at p1. Yeah.
So
order 2. So look, I'm dividing this by x to the p minus 1 over 2, okay? And I expand that. And to get the residue, what do I need? I need either the... Oh, I see. You're telling me that if I had higher order terms here, say I had... Yeah, you're telling me that if I had some high order term here, like 1 over x to the p minus 1 over 2, that you'd want me to find out what...
So are you claiming that you divide that by x to the power of p minus 1, then it's holomorphic around p1? You should divide the p minus 1 by p minus 1.
Pardon?
Correct.
Yeah, what they're asking is that say for example, so I'm taking this quantity here and dividing by x to the p minus 1 over 2. So, they're worried about the following, I think. So I have x minus 1, p minus 1 over 2, times x minus lambda, p minus 1 over 2, over x to the p minus 1 over 2. And now I start expanding that, and the residue might come from, you see, for example, suppose I had terms here like this, 1 over x squared plus 1 over x plus constant term and so on. And here I have 2 over x minus, yeah, let's just leave it like that, like this. Then they're worried about, here's another constant term, what this times this, for example, you're worried about, right? Wouldn't that contribute to the, but, okay, let's see why that, let's see, why would that, pardon? Y to the p minus 1 over x to the p minus 1?
Yeah,
it does, because x has a double zero at p1. So that is a zero of order 2, p minus 2, and y has a simple zero there, right? So that's true. Let me just see now what... Well, I mean, so this is a calculation. Look, if I divide this by x to the p minus 1, I have x to the p minus 1 over 2 on the top. So this is the thing I have, and this times 1 over x, right? So
So I just need, what do I need then from here? The constant term of this. Right? Dx is analytic at P1. Doesn't have a pole at P1. So I need so I have this times dx, and I'm trying to compute the residue at P1. So therefore, you think of P1 as zero, okay, for the time being. So then I'm basically looking for the coefficient of 1 over x in this expression. Right? So in other words, I'm looking for the constant term in this expression. Right? Look, you agree with me that I'm looking for the coefficient of 1 over x here? Yeah, let's pretend that P1 is 0, okay? Because I could, yeah. So it's the constant term in this, which is what I meant to say there. Something's bothering you. Okay, so anyway, if you believe this, some of you don't, then this would be, this is just an expansion, which is what? Which is summation P minus 1 over 2 nu times, let's say, over nu and mu, going from 0 to P minus 1 over 2, times P minus 1 over 2 mu, times x to the nu plus mu, times minus 1 to the P minus 1 over 2 minus nu, times minus lambda to the P minus 1 over 2 minus mu, and I want nu plus mu be equal to P minus 1 over 2. Okay, so then this is equal to 2 times nu, 0 to P minus 1 over 2, P minus 1 over 2 nu squared times, the coefficient. So this goes away here, right? I want the coefficient times minus 1 to the P minus 1, don't that cancels. Then I have minus 1 to the nu plus mu times lambda to the power nu. Okay, so basically it's write this again. It's 2 to the power, this is P minus 1 over 2, so minus 1 to the P minus 1 over 2 times this polynomial. And what is the answer now? The answer is that the P rank is 0. P rank is, for this to be 0, we need Frobenius to act trivially. So if this thing is non-zero, then the P rank is 1, right? P rank is 1 if lambda is not a root of the equation, the polynomial. So that's pretty explicit. And since the only two possibilities are P rank 0 and P rank 2, if it is a root, then the P rank is 0. If P rank is 0, lambda is a root. Okay, so look what this says. For example, for P equals 3, so P minus 1 over 2 is 1, so we have minus 2, and then the polynomial P minus 1 over 2 is 1, right? So it's just 1 plus lambda. So there's only one value of lambda that gives you P rank 0. So that, what does that mean? Over a field of characteristic 3, there is up to isogeny, except for isomorphism even. No, up to isogeny, there's only one elliptic curve of rank 0. Of 3 rank 0. Okay? That's a nice